From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And we still don't know why. Why Stephen Paddock opened fire in Las Vegas and killed 59 people. On his way to Puerto Rico this morning, President Trump said this about Paddock.
He's a sick man, a demented man. A lot of problems, I guess. And we're looking into him very, very seriously. But we're dealing with a very, very sick individual.
Trump also said lawmakers would take up gun control, quote, as time goes by. Let's get the latest from Las Vegas with John Sepulveda, who is there covering the story for KQED and NPR. John, do we know any more about Stephen Paddock's motive?
No, we don't, Jeremy. And I want to say something to the listeners. There are a lot of bad news stories, bad information that's going around about his motives. So unless you see it reported by someone with on social media with a little blue check mark, do not believe it. In Las Vegas, I have heard almost every possible explanation for why this person has done it. And authorities have no idea. And if they do, they are not releasing that information as of this hour.
Well, do we have any more information about how much planning might have gone into this? This was not something that he just decided to do and did. There was at least many days of him bringing suitcases full of weapons up to his room.
That's right. Suitcases where there was more than 20 weapons found. And not only that, there was ammonium nitrate in his trunk. So it's unclear what he wanted to do with that. Again, I think that part of the concern that authorities have is, as we've reached out to them, is that if they begin talking a little bit too much about the planning, that'll start to point people in the direction of motive. And authorities are really cautious about doing anything that could indicate a motive at this time. That being said, you are absolutely correct. There was a lot of planning that went into this, from the suite that they used. If you looked at the floor plan of the suite that this man used, he had two essentially eagle's nests to snipe at people from, to the hammer. When you go to Las Vegas, you don't want to do any – the hotels don't want anything that could lean against the glass or possibly break the glass. This glass is very, very tough, especially at that high level. And he brought either a very heavy hammer or some type of hammer, possibly a sledgehammer, to break that glass. So it's very, very clear that he went on Thursday, as other people were showing up to the Route 91 Country Music Festival to have a good time. He was showing up with at least the thought in his head that he might harm a lot of people, which he has. You know, 525 have been injured,
right.
59 dead of this hour.
Well, and investigators have also found a lot of weapons and explosives even on his property, right?
Yeah, they have found multiple guns. They just conducted they had two search warrants for – he had a home in Mesquite. Apparently, he was a wealthy individual. He had a home in Mesquite, which is about 90 miles northeast of Las Vegas, and then also one in North Nevada. I think the thing that is really shown through, though, from the police department is not necessarily what they're finding in this investigation, at least as of yet. It has really been amazing to see the police department here interact with the public and watch the community rally, talk about being battle-born, which, of course, is the Nevada state motto. This idea that they are resilient and that they'll get through it. And, of course, a lot of that has to do with the economics of it. They want people to continue to feel safe and come to Las Vegas. There are some 500,000 jobs that depend on that sector. So there is this real feeling in the community that they are going to get through it, even though there's this great tragedy.
Just a few seconds left, but how does it feel in Las Vegas today?
Surreal. It's been really – I saw a boot yesterday next to a concrete wall that somebody had left.
Right.
There was blood on it. It was like Cinderella if Cinderella was in a horror movie. It's insane.
That's John Sepulveda, who is in Las Vegas for KQED and NPR. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, yesterday, President Trump held a moment of silence for the victims of the Las Vegas shooting, and several Democratic lawmakers refused to participate. Now, this is not a new trend, but it's a growing one. After the 2015 San Bernardino shooting, Illinois Democratic Congresswoman Robin Kelly boycotted that congressional moment of silence, asking, when are we going to do more than stand? Congressman Jim Himes was the first of three lawmakers to boycott the moment of silence after a shooter killed 49 in Orlando's Pulse nightclub. He pointed to his home state of Connecticut and the Sandy Hook shooting deaths of 20 first graders and 6 adults, saying, "Our silence does not honor the victims, it mocks them." Well, Representative Seth Moulton joined Himes in that boycott, and the Democrat from Massachusetts also boycotted yesterday's moment. He joins us by Skype. Congressman, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
And take us through your thinking. From what I gather, you had something of a conversion after Orlando and Congressman Himes. You'd originally tweeted out, it's almost the cliched response from lawmakers, our thoughts and prayers are with the victims. Then what happened?
Then I started hearing from the victims and their families and people who said, we've got to do more. We've got to do something about this to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah. Well, and let's remind people, you're an Iraq War veteran, you're military. How hard a decision was that for you not to do what some people feel is an important ritual?
I'm someone who's seen firsthand the effects of gun violence. I've had to carry a gun to do my job in the war. And I know, as well as anyone, that this violence has no place on our streets, in our schools, at our concerts. So we've got to do something about it. And too often, I think these moments of silence are just excuses for inaction in Congress.
Well, hence the hashtags now, no more silence. And where's the bill? And we're reminded that when Speaker Paul Ryan tried to call that moment of silence after Orlando, you know, some Democratic lawmakers were shouting out, where's the bill? Where's the law that would prevent some of the guns involved in these shootings? But in Las Vegas, Congressman, we have a shooter who would have passed every background check. No issues that anyone can find at all, from mental health through ideology. What exactly do you want Congress to do?
Well, there's a lot we can do, and we don't know all the details of Las Vegas yet, so it's premature to say what exactly could have prevented this particular tragedy. But there's enormous evidence that having universal background checks for gun purchases, which is something that 9 out of 10 Americans support, that reduces gun violence. It's common sense that if you're too dangerous to get on a plane, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And that's why I have a bipartisan bill that will prevent terrorists from buying guns.
So you're talking about universal background checks, again, that might, you know, not have done anything to prevent Las Vegas. But tell us more.
We don't know yet.
We don't know. We don't know. Right. But tell us more about what it would do. What does that mean, a universal background check, for those who don't know?
Well, it just means that no matter where you buy a gun, whether it's through a legitimate dealer or at a gun show from a private seller, that you have to go through a background check. And right now, there are loopholes so that you have to go through a background check if you buy it from a gun dealer, but not if you get it at a gun show. And this is just common sense stuff to prevent people who have mental illnesses or criminal records from getting guns. And it's been shown time and time again to reduce gun violence. So whether or not it would have eliminated this particular tragedy is not the issue here. This is a problem that happens time and time again across this country. And so there's no single solution that will prevent every gun massacre, but there are a lot of things we can do to make them less likely and less deadly.
What about reports that we're hearing, the Associated Press, New York Times, that officials who were in the hotel room in Las Vegas say that there were devices there that would have allowed the shooter to take a long rifle and convert it into an automatic weapon. Now, automatic weapons, are illegal, new ones are, but you can buy, it's perfectly legal to buy a device to convert a rifle to an automatic weapon. What's your thinking on that?
Well, this is a great example of a law that we could pass that would have had an influence on this tragedy. You know, it would have made a big difference if he wasn't able to use automatic rifle fire. He would have killed far fewer people.
Well, back to the way you're expressing this, by not participating in the moment of silence. You say you heard from victims after you did tweet out, your prayers after Orlando. But what about those who say this is disrespectful to victims of a massacre? Not to just have a moment, as Nancy Pelosi said after yesterday's moment of silence, it's not a license to not do anything.
But unfortunately, I think politicians in Washington are using it that way. And we've got to call attention to this and say that just simply honoring the victims is not enough. If I thought that they would do something, that we could have a debate or a vote on many of these bipartisan bills that have been proposed, then I would happily and honorably participate in a moment of silence. But that's how bad it's become, that Speaker Ryan, the Republican leadership, can't simply do their jobs as members of the House of Representatives in debating this issue and having votes on things to make it better.
Do you worry that Democrats in boycotting a moment of silence are falling into a trap, a political trap? It's been called identity politics. You know, this idea of seeming to care more about anti-gun legislation than prayer, which is precious to many people. Are you worried about that for Democrats?
No, that's what President Trump and Republicans who are trying to politicize this issue will say about Democrats. But the reality here is that Democrats are the only ones who are showing the courage to have this debate and to actually do something about these issues.
Representative Seth Moulton, the Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, on why he boycotted yesterday's moment of silence. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Let's begin by saying that we are living through a very dangerous time. Words written 55 years ago by African-American social critic James Baldwin, addressing a group of educators about how to speak with students about the headlines of the 60s. Well, fast forward to today. Clint Smith is a writer, a PhD candidate at Harvard. His terrific poetry collection is titled Counting Dissent. He's also been a teacher who's struggled with making teaching relevant. Natural disasters, neo-Nazis and white supremacists, battles over NFL football players taking a knee, the threat of nuclear war with North Korea, the repeal of DACA, putting the future of 800,000 immigrants at risk, just some of the things happening outside the classroom. So Clint turned back to James Baldwin. Clint Smith is here to talk about his piece for The New Yorker, James Baldwin's Lessons for Teachers in a Time of Turmoil. Clint, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, put this in context. Tell us about the time in 1963 that Baldwin was talking about.
This was a moment. John F. Kennedy had just been killed. Medgar Evers, who was a prominent NAACP organizer in Mississippi, had just been assassinated. The Birmingham bombing of the four little girls in the church at 16th Street Baptist Church had just taken place. And so this was an incredibly contentious time in the United States with regard to issues of race and inequality and social stratification. And in many ways, you know, revisiting this essay feels as if it could have been written the other day. That's the power of Baldwin and why he's experienced such a sort of renaissance, because his work is in many ways prophetic and his work is speaking to his lifetime. But many of the issues that he was wrestling with are things that we're struggling with today.
So take us back in time for you. You were teaching in a high school and you were feeling this disconnect between the sentence structure that you had to teach and what you knew that kids were thinking about. Tell us about what you encountered.
Right. I think I came into the classroom and I initially was like deeply committed to pushing back against the sort of normative structures of standardized testing and the idea that the singular metrics for student success should be tied to their math or their reading score. And I wanted to engage in a sort of broader project of helping students develop a critical consciousness and deeper sense of empathy in the world. But as is often the case, you find yourself becoming tied to the metrics of success in that environment. And there was a moment where I was teaching about sentence structure and syntax, and Trayvon Martin had just been killed, and a myriad of students that they knew from other schools had just been killed. And I think I fell victim to the fear of wanting to create an apolitical space in the classroom. And revisiting a talk to teachers served as a really important reminder that the very decision to not discuss certain things in your classroom is in and of itself a political decision, because my students' lives are impacted by political decisions every single day. And I think it's important for teachers to think about ways to try to facilitate and create a space where they can engage in those conversations in a meaningful way.
Well, how do you do that in such a divisive climate? You write about a friend of yours, a teacher in Washington in an elementary school. He had to answer questions about those protests in Charlottesville, white supremacists marching out in the open with Nazis, when a man rammed his car through a crowd of counter-protesters, killed a woman. You know, a student asks, why was somebody so angry that they wanted to drive a car through people asking for their rights? That's almost an easier question, you know, that there is hate. Let's say taking on a debate over whether or not, you know, football players should kneel during the national anthem. That's one that parents might not want you to take up in the classroom.
Yeah, so I think oftentimes what happens is we conflate the idea that certain things should be discussed in a classroom with the notion that a teacher is going to indoctrinate students with their own beliefs. And I think that that is not actually what critical pedagogy is. Critical pedagogy is this idea that you are going to create a space in your classroom in which students are able to develop their own sense of critical consciousness and engagement with the world. And what does it mean for me as a critically and culturally responsive educator to provide the space for you to understand the social and historical and political context that led us to this moment, where people's arguments on either side are stemming from? And what does it mean for you to have conversations with your classmates about these issues that might push you to think differently about something? So I think we really have to make sure that we're not ignoring these issues in our classrooms, but instead tackling them head on.
Well, because so much of our real history has been ignored in our classrooms. And that was one of James Baldwin's points, that they're sort of fairy tales.
Right.
You know, revolutionaries in America wanted to overthrow the British who had control over them while they owned slaves. You know, Reconstruction was a falsehood, that it quickly became almost re-enslavement. Learning that Roosevelt pretty much cut blacks out of the New Deal.
Right.
That post-World War II, blacks were pretty much cut out of all the financial advances there because they couldn't get loans and buy homes because of redlining, and so decades later don't have that wealth to pass on. I can see, though, that in some schools that might be tricky.
I think it demands a certain level of courage from the administrators, a certain level of courage from the teachers. And as you brought up, you know, the New Deal is something that we're always taught is the most progressive series of legislative acts that have ever been signed. They are what created the contemporary middle class. They are responsible for decades and decades of intergenerational wealth and upward mobility, which they are, but only for white people, right? Because black people were not given access to Social Security, minimum wage protection, health care, housing mortgages, the GI Bill, and all of the different things that created the social bedrock of intergenerational wealth in the early 20th century. And so if a student doesn't understand that certain things at the beginning of the 20th century that are responsible for the accumulation of wealth were given to one demographic of people and then not given to a different demographic of people, any social scientist will tell you it is inevitable that they will experience disparate outcomes. And again, but this is something that, you know, many of our students don't know, but also many of our teachers aren't being taught. And so it also demands that we think differently about how we're engaging in professional development. When I was a teacher, I never had professional development conversations around the history of the neighborhood where I taught or what it meant to put my students' academic experiences in conversation with mass incarceration and housing segregation and immigration and food insecurity. Because we so often operate under the false pretense that our classrooms are these somehow sanctuaries that are not affected by the rest of the world, but our students leave our classrooms and go out into a world in which they are deeply affected by the socio-political phenomena that they experience every day.
There have always been whites who have walked with blacks in the civil rights struggle, but it seems like there's a slightly different tone now. And I may be wrong, but it feels like it's more whites talking about their own white privilege as opposed to wanting equal rights for blacks. And I'm thinking of Greg Popovich, coach of the San Antonio Spurs, in the midst of the whole NFL kneeling controversy. Here's what he had to say on the team's media day.
There has to be an uncomfortable element in the discourse for anything to change. People have to be made to feel uncomfortable, and especially white people, because we're comfortable. We still have no clue of what being born white means.
Does that encourage you?
It does. I'm not sure what critical race theory courses Greg Popovich has secretly been sitting in, but I was incredibly heartened to hear him speak that way. And, you know, in that interview, he goes on to talk about how race and how whiteness is actually something that is not real. It's something that is made up. And for one of the best coaches in the history of the National Basketball Association to be digging deep into, like, literature around race and racecraft. When the Irish came to the United States, they weren't considered white. When the Italians came to the United States, they weren't considered white. But what happens over time is that the line of whiteness is always moved in order to maintain social stratification and to maintain power. And the line will continue to move.
And again, how do you have that conversation about white privilege in a classroom where you have poor white kids who don't feel at all privileged?
Yeah, and I think that that demands a nuanced understanding of how it is that allow us to navigate the world as both people who are oppressed and people who are complicit in oppression. On one end, as a Black person, I am a member of a community that has been historically oppressed. And as a man and as a straight person, I am part of a community that benefits from the existence of patriarchy, notions of how gender operates. It's like when you're in the water park and you're on the lazy river, you can say, well, I'm not doing anything to swim along, but you are allowing yourself to be part of the current. And it's hard to say, I'm going to get off of this proverbial raft and like walk against the current when it would be much easier for me to sit on the raft. You know, some people will come up to me and they'll say, well, how do you have a conversation about race with young children? And the important thing is that we've done this for a long time with regard to the environment, right? And so you don't go to a second grader and say, well, centuries of climate change means Indonesia and Miami will be engulfed in water and not exist within the next 20 years. So say goodbye to those people. That would be irresponsible. Similarly, we wouldn't go to a second grader and say, white supremacy is a fundamentally ingrained facet of American history and has been since 1619, and there's nothing you can do about it. What you can say, and what we do in the context of the environment, is we talk about recycling or to turn the lights off, right? You scaffold the conversation to be appropriate for the person of that age. And similarly, I think you can have conversations pushing back against the idea of colorblindness, for example, right? Making sure that young people grow up understanding that race has very different and real implications and we shouldn't pretend as if it doesn't exist, but we should appreciate each person for who they are in the different facets of their identity.
That's Clint Smith, a writer, PhD candidate at Harvard, author of Counting Dissent, and also a teacher. We'll post James Baldwin's A Talk to Teachers at hereandnow.org. Clint, thanks so much for reminding us of it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We're learning more about the victims of the massacre in Las Vegas. The gunman who fired on a crowd of concertgoers late Sunday night killed 59 people. They were mothers and fathers, husbands and wives. And they came to Las Vegas from all across the country. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd is in the studio to tell us a little more about a couple of them. Peter, you've been learning about Sonny Melton, a registered nurse who was at the concert with his wife for their first wedding anniversary. What do we know about him?
Yeah, Sonny Melton was 29 years old. He was from Tennessee. He worked in a local emergency room at the hospital there. He was pretty new to the job, and we know that because he graduated from the Union University School of Nursing in 2015. The school put out a statement after his death and said that Sonny was energetic. He had a positive attitude that was infectious. They said, you could not help but smile when you saw him. He was a natural choice for class president. The school said that nursing was Sonny's calling, and he served well as the hands and feet of Jesus. That's a Christian school. And I think that that was on display in his final moments because his wife, Heather, and remember, this, they're celebrating their first wedding anniversary, said that Sonny saved her life. When the gunshots started, he grabbed her. They started running. He was hit in the back, and he shielded her from the bullets.
Well, the local news station WSMV spoke with people who knew Sonny in his hometown of Big Sandy, Tennessee, and they said it was no surprise that he tried to protect his wife from the gunfire.
He loved her. You know, he would have done anything to her. I mean, he would have done that for anybody. I mean, that was just, I think it was just second nature to him to do something like that.
Doesn't surprise me at all. I think he'd have done it for a complete stranger. It's just the kind of person he was.
And it was that willingness to help that may have cost him his life.
Yeah, I think Sonny is an example of what was happening that night. There's so many stories of strangers pulling injured people out of the gunfire by their arms and legs, you know, throwing their bodies on top of people they didn't even know to protect them from the gunfire. So for some of the people who did not make it out of that concert, I think that, you know, that will be part of their legacy.
We're also learning more about Rhonda LaRocque. Tell us about her.
Rhonda was 42. She's from Massachusetts. She was at the concert with her husband and her young daughter. The daughter, luckily, had just left the concert with her grandfather right before the shooting started. Her husband was not physically injured. He said that he thought Rhonda had ducked to escape the gunfire when she fell, but she didn't duck. She had actually been hit. Rhonda's half-sister, Jennifer Zelensky, was completely distraught when she spoke yesterday to the local NBC affiliate.
She was amazing. She was amazing. A great mom. great wife, great sister. She did what she could. She always had something nice to say when you needed it.
Rhonda was the oldest of four girls in her family. She was described as being the heart and soul of that family. And it's important to say her faith was important to her. She was a Jehovah's Witness. And a Facebook post from another sister of hers speaks to this. The sister said that she is paralyzed by this news, but she said, "All I can do is turn to God's word for comfort, just as Rhonda would want me to do."
Let's hear now is Peter O'Dowd with more on some of the victims of the Las Vegas massacre. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's been less than a week since Republicans unveiled their plan to overhaul the tax code. We've already heard some criticism that it's more helpful to the rich than the middle class, that it'll balloon the federal deficit. Joining us now with his view is former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, a Republican who is now CEO of Financial Services Roundtable, a lobbying group for the finance industry. Governor Pawlenty, welcome. And what do you think of the tax plan?
Well, so far it's a blueprint with a lot of details to be filled in, but directionally it seems to encourage and accomplish the goal of trying to reduce taxes, simplify the tax code with the overall goal of stimulating the economy. And in a country that's had sub 2% GDP growth, we need to do something to get this economy going, and this could be a key ingredient to that goal.
But it would also increase the deficit hugely, right? In the trillions.
Well, it depends. Bob Corker, who's one of the key people on the federal budget, said he wouldn't vote for a tax bill that adds one penny to the national debt going forward. So we'll see. This has in a gross sense, and I don't mean that as an ugly, I mean that as an overall effect, $5 trillion or so of impact. But when you net out the so-called pay-fors, which is all kind of gobbledygook speak, it could have a trillion to a $2 trillion negative impact on the debt going forward. And that would be concerning. And then also there's a chapter two, which is they're going to talk about adding some things that would help reduce or eliminate that impact on the deficit. So there's a lot of road yet ahead of us.
But there were claims during the Bush years that the Bush tax cuts would pay for themselves, and they didn't.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And so the question is going to be, what did we learn from that in terms of who was right, who was wrong, what methodology was accurate or not? And again, for your listeners who don't follow all this inside baseball, there's something called the Congressional Budget Office or the CBO, which has historically been the official scorekeeper. And they will project whether there is or isn't an impact on the debt and deficit. And then the question for Republicans in particular, since they control the Congress, will be, do you believe and are you willing to rely on that score? Or are you going to say it's inaccurate and we're going to adopt a different methodology? And that's where there's going to be a real fork in the road in this debate. And it's too early to tell yet what the CBO is going to say.
What about the argument that has been made so far by opponents of this tax plan that it is not for the middle class, that it is just going to be another big tax cut for the wealthy, whether you look at what it's doing to the corporate tax or what it's doing to the tax brackets?
Again, that would be concerning, but if you take the administration and the Congress at their word in terms of when they fill in the details and all the other meat that's to come on the bones, what they're saying is we have a number of goals in mind. First goal is let's get the economy moving above the anemic rate that it's growing currently and has been for years. So that's goal number one. Goal number two, let's get rates down so that they're internationally competitive, particularly for businesses. And number three, let's make sure that the impact of all of this is not skewed towards the rich. Let's make sure that the net benefit or the largest benefit proportionally is on the middle class. And there's a lot of early criticism of this blueprint saying, well, it's too skewed towards the wealthy. But again, this is just a blueprint and we're going to have to see it in total before you can reach that final conclusion. But I think having a disproportionate benefit to the middle class is an important goal and one that the administration has said and the Congress has said is important to them as well. So the proof will be in the pudding.
Well, one issue that's been brought up is the lower tax rate for so-called pass-through businesses. Republicans say this will benefit small businesses, but critics have called it a backdoor way to cut taxes for giant corporations that might be classified as partnerships or sole proprietorships. What do you think about that cut down to 25% for pass-through businesses?
Again, for your listeners who may not follow all the details of this, there's different types of companies in terms of their legal form. One type is called a C corporation, which is usually the publicly traded large companies. And for that, they're saying we're going to take the sticker price of taxation from 35% now down to 20%. But the vast majority of American businesses are not those C corps. They are partnerships, they're limited liability companies, or so-called pass-through entities. And so they pay their taxes usually on their individual returns. The proceeds of their stake in their businesses gets carried forward and passed through. That's why they call them pass-throughs, on their individual returns. And individual rates, of course, can go as high as 39%. And if you add the Obamacare taxes, it can be into the 40s. So people are, I think, correctly and fairly saying, well, if you're going to reduce the rates for those big C-corps, you should also reduce them for the pass-throughs so we don't have this big delta between those two types of corporations. So again, that's a long-winded answer, but you can't just say we're going to reduce corporate rates for one type of business and not for others. And you got to do it across the board, or at least proportionately across the board.
But in the end, if you're doing it across the board, you're going to have a lot less money coming into the federal coffers, aren't you?
Well, what you have now, of course, is the U.S. having one of the highest tax rates in the developed world at 35% for C-corps. And you have a bunch of companies doing all kinds of gimmicks and tricks, including inversions, pushing businesses and revenues and investments to foreign countries because they don't think the American tax rate is welcoming or competitive. So you have to modernize the tax code to make it competitive. Otherwise, we're going to continue to lose business revenues to foreign companies, or countries, I should say.
What is the case to be made for eliminating the estate tax? Why should it be a priority in this tax plan to give a break to people inheriting, in some cases, multimillion-dollar estates from their wealthy parents?
Well, it is essentially eliminated already for much of America because there's an exemption. I forget the exact amount, but let's say it's $5 million hypothetically. And for most Americans, when they die, they don't have $5 million of assets, so there is no estate tax. But for people who have large estates, there's a big estate tax. And then many states, including my own of Minnesota, has an additional estate tax. I think the argument is you shouldn't have to pay a death tax when you've already paid taxes along the way on the money you've earned, on the investments you've made and the returns that they've produced. You've paid through your whole life taxes on all that stuff. So why should you have to pay again a special tax just because you died?
Hmm. But aren't you worried that all of this cutting taxes, yes, maybe it does lead to more economic growth, but it also could lead to more income inequality in this country. And we know that's such a big problem right now.
There's a huge concern around income inequality. And of course, there's correlations between your income and a variety of things, not just taxes, but education levels, for example. As to taxes, we have a tax rate in this country that has the top individual rate at nearly 40%. And then you add to that the state and local tax burdens. If you're in a high tax state like Minnesota, it's another 10%. So that gets you to 50%. And if you add on the local and sales tax and also the Obamacare taxes, again, at a gross macro level, you can get above 50% taxation rates.
Which is historically low, though, you must admit. I mean, it was much higher decades ago.
It was higher. In the Reagan era, at 75 or 80% marginal rates, and then they reduced it to something much lower. But again, you got to keep in mind with all this stuff, it's not just the sticker price. You got to look at the effective rate or the net rate after all these special deductions, credits, exemptions, and the like are factored in. And that's a big part of tax reform is simplification. So we want to not only lower rates, but also clean up the tax code so that, you know, there isn't all these little special deals or loopholes or, you know, preferences for individual industries or individual types of behaviors, because then basically have politicians favoring one group over another using the tax code as their a way to bestow these favors. And that's why a lot of Republicans, including me, think a lot of that is crony capitalism or politicians bestowing favors on certain groups. And we'd like to get the tax code lower rates, but limit or reduce the number of those special privileges.
Do you expect that the final tax plan from the Republicans is going to include an increase in taxes for the top earners? Because it sounds like President Trump has left the door open to that potentially.
It doesn't sound like it. I know the presidents maybe and others have suggested that, but I think more recently, in recent weeks, that has been, you know, not something that's been on the table or discussed and doesn't look like it's going forward.
Do you think that it is likely that this will actually pass in the end? Because you would have thought that the Obamacare repeal and replace would have passed by now, but it didn't.
I think this will pass for a number of reasons. One is it's important to do. We've got to do some things to get the economy moving, as we discussed before. Number two, we do have a tax code that's out of date and not competitive as benchmarked against other developed countries in the world, particularly as it relates to business taxes. Three, middle-income America needs some more money in their pockets, obviously, and so middle-income tax relief would be a terrific outcome as well. So there's meritorious reasons to do this, and it should get done. But then also politically, it's an imperative. If you're a Republican and you've run around this country for 10 years telling supporters and donors and others, we're going to for sure reform and improve and modernize and our tax code, including reducing it, and they don't do it, particularly on the heels of the failure of Obamacare, they will have heck to pay within their own party, much less the broader public, when they go into the 2018 election. So I think for all of those reasons, they're going to do it, and I'm confident that they'll get something done.
That's Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, now CEO of Financial Services Roundtable. Governor Pawlenty, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
More than one out of every 10 people in the U.S. is food insecure. They don't know where the next meal is coming from. In remote Northern California, that number is closer to one out of five. Lisa Morehouse met one man who's helping feed his neighbors in Trinity County.
The sun's barely up in the tiny town of Douglas City. Three men are almost done packing a couple of trucks with food.
We're loaded to the gills. There's produce, there's cabbage, white onions, sweet potatoes, the senior boxes, there's salmon.
Jeff England's the director of the Trinity County Food Bank. I hop into the cab of his 20-year-old truck to join him on his monthly food delivery run to the county's hungriest and most isolated residents. Today's his longest route, and he'll clock 230 miles. Inside the Solid Rock Church in the town of Hayfork, more than 50 people wait in line to pick up food, which England cobbles together from a spider's web of local, state, and federal programs.
Would you like some tea now? Do you have a little card?
And without the food bank, you just go without.
Teresa Kirkland is a volunteer, but she also comes to pick up free food.
I'm on Social Security. After you pay all your bills, if you have an emergency, a flat tire, or anything that you have to take care of, well, that has to wait until the following month.
It's be a long, long month.
Glenda Rains and Kirkland say they used to supplement their budgets by taking items to a local recycling center, but that's closed now. Rains says until recently, she and her husband were homeless, camping out by the creek.
The friend let us stay there in their garage made into a little cabin-like. I don't know how long this is going to last, but yeah, I'm still considered homeless.
Rains prepares the food she receives on a little propane stove. More than 10 California counties actually have higher poverty than Trinity, but people here are more likely to be hungry or not sure they'll have enough food than anywhere else in the state. To learn more, I meet up with Farmers Market founder Sue Corrigan in the historic town of Weaverville.
Still have zucchini. I think we need some onions for some onion rings, huh?
She points to one produce vendor and tells me something surprising.
This is my actual local farmer.
The only one from Trinity County among the 10 or so farmers here at the market. Corrigan says years ago, much of the potential farmland was taken out of commission. Her family farmed for over a century, but stopped in the 1950s.
Because the government was taking our land.
To build the Trinity Dam, which sends water to central and southern California.
One of our last areas that was open enough to do farming, and they buried it with a lake.
She says it's all about priorities.
We've had three different rushes that have happened in Trinity County. First, the gold rush, second, the timber rush, and now the marijuana rush, which is called the green rush. And so focus has been on other industries and not a food sustainable industry.
Jeff England maneuvers around potholes to get to the most remote drop-off point today. He tells me about last winter when he defied state highway workers and drove a closed, snow-covered road to deliver food to people who'd been stuck for months.
And I said, I have to go. Lost traction, gained traction, and I knew that they, you know, they needed the food. And so I decided to take a chance, and I made it.
That's good. That takes a lot of guts. Because even coming up the back of the mountain, they call it Refrigerator Alley for a reason. It gets pretty slick.
That's Lauren Turner, who's come to the food drop-off at the volunteer fire department in the tiny town of Zinnia. As for grocery store shopping?
Usually it's 100 miles in any direction from here to a large town where you can buy groceries.
More than a two-hour drive each way. She does that only once a month. In between, she relies on the food bank delivery. Jeff England says he and his team have more than doubled the amount of food they're bringing into Trinity County in the last year. They deliver one bag or box of food to 2,500 households each month, 20% of the county. He says the community is incredibly supportive. And if there's one complaint he hears, it's that the food bank just enables drug addicted or homeless people.
And I said, we don't judge people. And you know, those druggies have kids. The kids might not get food normally.
That lack of judgment, it comes from personal experience. England says he's been out of work before.
And I've struggled in the past, a long time ago, with some addiction problems. And it just felt so good to be able to go to a place when you're hungry.
He remembers that first meal in a soup kitchen.
It was spaghetti. I had garlic bread and a salad. A lot of people don't know what it is to be hungry. You're weak, you can't do anything, you don't have any ambitions because you're hungry. I mean, and then you get a little food in you and you feel good about it. And I'm so happy to be able to turn the table.
And he says, help the people whose shoes he's been in before. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
And Lisa's story was produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit investigative news organization. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.